he's the rationalist press.
Oh, right, yeah. I don't know much about him.
He accuses me of not being an anarchist. Which I think he's probably right.
Oh, is that his letter there?
Yes, sure.
Well, yeah, I don't have. I think they're a bit of a decadent outfit, really.
Who?
Well,
the anarchist.
Free thinker.
Yeah, well, the free. And are you talking about the anarchist or the free thinker?
The free thinker, really.
Oh, that's different.
Isn't it? Isn't that what Nicholas.
No.
Oh.
He's.
Sorry.
Director of the Rational Press Association. A leading member of SPES, and probably England's most prolific anarchist. Although Colin Ward might be deserving of that title.
Okay. I've got a suggestion here. I've got a whole list of dates with events, which I thought I might go through. I mean, they're not a huge number. And
yeah.
then there's a list of people which you can sort of go through.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the, you know, people like Blake and some of the stuff, and then ideas and general comments. Well, that would be a sensible format. There's so much ground to cover.
Got to start somewhere.
Got to start somewhere, exactly. What's your date of birth, actually? I guessed it at 1915, I think. Is that insultingly wrong?
Yes. 26th of January, 1921.
21.
I'm 75.
Right. So it's not so. Yeah, so it wasn't something really, wasn't it? Okay, let me just go through this sort of list of things here. These are mostly taken out of what we chatted about before. There's medieval stuff. Carthusians seem to figure out rather largely. The 16th century Ireland with tribal chiefs fighting each other. Various enclosure movements, or processes anyway. 1530, the first radical Puritans, such as the Presbyterians and Anabaptists. You mentioned the 50...
And the Baptists, became slightly later.
Do they? Well, right. Mm-hmm. 1590s, you had down as a golden age, according to my notes.
First Armada, yes.
Mm. 1640s, the decade of first principles.
Mm-hmm.
Right. All right?
No.
What happened about the stationers' company?
1690s.
Right. Were printers no longer licensed?
Stationers' company held a firm grip until the Civil War.
Right. Oh, I see. I must have got that. Date wrong. I've got his 1793 Elhanan Winchester founds. I take it that's South Place or the predecessor of it.
That's right.
Yeah. Now you've got down Scott as being the inventor of the Romantic myth.
Principal inventor. Yes.
It goes back to chivalry, that sort of thing.
No, it goes back to a Gothic novel.
Oh, well, that's
17. 45 or thereabouts.
Yes, you mean.
What's his name?
Castle Rackrent or something. Castle of Otranto.
Yeah, that's right, Castle of Otranto.
Okay. And of course, there was a neo romantic thing in the 19th century and so on. Okay, I've got down here 1815 to 1867, Industrial Revolution. I don't know if that's, you agree with that.
It should be 77 to 76 is when the steam engine was first used. I mean, you can have any number of dates.
Yeah, I don't know why that came out. Maybe that was in an SPS thing or something. Okay, now, 1825 to 1850, Bentham captured Parliament, the city, and the universities.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. And 1835, the charters were kind of destroyed by Bentham. That's of towns, in other words.
Yes, the Municipal Corporations Act.
Yeah, Corporations Act. Right, in the middle 1840s, according to a book I read on Calvin, predestination was claimed to be central to his doctrine. I was interested in Calvin because he was on your list of.
Yes, but that goes back to the 16th century.
Yeah, it's just that in the 1840s it was sort of being elevated. The idea that the predestination was claimed to be central, and that view apparently has been kind of challenged. It's just a point which is what somebody else said. Anyway, middle 1850s-ish, you've got the Indian Mutiny, Crimea, competitive examinations.
Mm-hmm.
The second reform bill, things like that. Okay.
67.
Yeah, 67. Second reform bill, yeah. 1889, the Great Dock Strike,
mm-hmm.
which I've got in my notes. You said gave people the idea that they could get careers in the Labour Party.
Yes, Kropotkin identified this as the turning point, which was a total disaster because people stopped thinking and went for jobs and promotion.
Right. By 1900, you'd had things like Taffy and Osborne Judgment.
A little bit later than 1900.
I've got down here 1901 Blackpool trams. I think there must have been discussion on transport or something. And 1910 Edward Thompson goes to India as a missionary.
That's his father, yes.
Yeah, his father, right. About 1914 or 15, the Official Secrets Act was introduced. You know, defence of the realm, all this kind of stuff like that. Supposedly for spying, I think you said.
MI5, 1909. Yeah.
1909?
Yeah.
Was that really? What about MI6?
I'm not sure about MI6, it's later. MI5 is the founding one.
Was there an MI1 to 4?
Military intelligence.
Yeah, I know. Were there 1s to 4 also?
No, 1 to 2.
Right.
They had various departments, 1 to 6. You should read the Spycatcher on this, it's very good.
Oh, is it?
Mm.
Oh, right, I didn't realize you went into the history of it.
There's a very good initial history. Yeah.
Okay. See, well, I've got down in 1918 Lord Londonderry's mineral rights. That's nothing to do with, that wasn't what you said, that was something to do with Newcastle and mining and so on. People were still making a fortune out of owning mines.
Yes.
Okay, 1921 Lenin betrays the workers, naval base off Petrograd. That's all I
yes, what do you call the place? The sailors of the navy rebelled. And Lenin and Trotsky crushed it by horrendous violence. And that was a moment of arch betrayal.
And that, you date the decline of communism from there?
No, you can date it to 1902-03. Mm. The second, when they met in London here, in a pub in the East End, and Lenin wrote, Where Do We Go From Here? Or whatever it was called. No, what is to be done? And put forward the theory of the party of the vanguard.
The vanguard, yes, it's the.
And which he turns into a professional party, and only professional people could join it, really.
Right.
And so he ruins the whole notion of it, there being a people's movement, you know.
And I presume that was implicit in it most of the time, really, because they were. I mean, they spent all their time studying Marxism, which was not exactly a popular.
That's right. Or breaking banks open to finance them.
Yes, right. Mm. Anyway, at this point, you're now age zero. Is that so? Okay, now in the 1930s, I remember you saying that Hewlett Johnson, you know, was fated by the Soviet Union.
Oh, yes.
And you decided, or somebody told you, that great men were largely moved, or clever men were largely moved by vanity.
Yes, unfortunately, that's true.
Mm, mm, okay. And let me see, in the 30s, when you were about 10 or so, The History of the Russian Revolution was published by Trotsky in a translation by Eastman, 2 volumes, I think it was.
Yeah.
And 1937, when you were about 16, Trotsky's book on the revolution betrayed was
that's
published.
Right, quite an important work. Yeah.
Mm. And, you know, it hadn't kind of occurred to me until I was listening to people talking about Ellis Hillman, that, of course, Trotsky was quite a sort of living presence. I mean, it wasn't just a theoretical thing.
Yes,
you know what I mean?
Yes. I knew his secretary. She died last year.
His secretary? She in England?
No, in America. She came over here. I was her first publisher. And I'm not thinking here. 1939-40.
Do you remember her name?
Pardon?
Do you remember her name?
Okay. I have a devastating effect on my memory. When you know somebody quite well and can't remember their name. That's what I published here. Her first work published in this country, Raya Dunayevskaya. And I published on behalf of the Cambridge Left Group in 1961.
The Left Group, Cambridge University, right.
Yes, but I was responsible, really, for starting the New Left in Cambridge University.
Right, so she was a thinker in her own right, not just a...
No, very much so. She founded a newspaper called News and Comment. Which,
in America, in the US?
Yes, in Chicago, and I took it for years. But she had male sort of vanity. She wanted to be the ruler of her own thing. And, you know, you can't do it unless you can. I have to relate to equals, and if people are determined to be prima donnas, there's nothing you can do about it, really. So I broke with her eventually. Rather sad, because she was very brilliant.
That's why Trotsky selected her as a secretary, presumably.
She must have been very beautiful, too, as a girl. That might have been relevant. Trotsky had an eye for women.
Yes. Actually, in fact, I'm sure the wife... I remember seeing Isaac Deutscher's wife on TV discussing a film of Lenin, of Trotsky, you know, before he was murdered. Mm-hmm. And I could tell by what she was saying, it seemed to me anyway, that she was... She wanted to marry Trotsky. She was envious of Trotsky. She kept saying how sugary and insipid Trotsky's wife was. Does that ring a bell?
Well, I have a high regard for Trotsky's wife. She's rather a marvellous person.
Well, but Tamara Deutscher seemed to be kind of jealous of her.
Well, yes, no doubt.
Anyway, it's no big deal, I suppose.
Raya was... and she came over here in 60, 61, and I published this thing because I found it in a bookshop, and... they had to rewrite the whole document because her English is ghastly.
Okay.
Every sentence had to be
out. I've also got down here 1938, that's when you were 17, People's History of England by A.L. Morton. Now, I've read some of Morton's books, and most of them are very sentimental things about the Scottish and Welsh, aren't they? Kind of Irish.
Well, that's the first. That's a very seminal book, actually. It anticipates the history group of the Communist Party, which was formed at the end of the war and dissolved in 56 by. The executive committee, which Thompson and Christopher Hill and Eric Hobsbawm and all the rest were members of. And he was a sort of father of that group.
That's interesting.
He wrote a History of England, which I've got here.
Yes.
I think it's in print. It's rather good history, actually, but it takes a class struggle point of view, but it's also very humane. I mean,
yeah.
The trouble with English Marxists, as Churchill once said, I don't worry about English communists because they're English. You know,
yes, I'm sure.
They won't go over to absurd dogmas and authoritarian relationships.
Were you influenced by Wells? I mean, Wells is history.
It changed my life. Absolutely. The most influential book I've ever read.
Outline of History.
That's right. I was 18, 19 when I read it. And it may have been an internationalist into a European. And it really was a very seminal work for me.
Hmm.
Just, I mean, it's not a very good book, actually. It's quite deservedly not in print anymore. But it takes the world's culture as a whole, you see.
Hmm.
You don't presume that Christianity is the religion, because Hinduism and Buddhism and the others are given equal treatment, you see.
So it was China, wasn't it? Well, not exactly equal, but...
Well, he gave everybody a fair... crack of the whip. Well, that's so seemed to me, and he had this tremendous historical sense about the ancient world too. His anthropology was ghastly.
Did you read the 2-volume sort of model? It was later produced in a 1-volume thing with.
Yes, I had the 1-volume one.
Yeah, right. With illustrated by Horobin and so on.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
He also produced 2 other books. One's called The Science of Life with his with.
With
Huxley. Huxley's son, actually. And the other one was Work, Wealth and Happiness of Mankind, about economics, which is a bit of a flop.
Hmm.
But I read The Science of Life, which is a huge book.
Yes.
And got to understand a bit about biology, you know, evolution and so on. But those 2 books, and he wrote lots of other books, like The World Brain, and he had this tremendous sense of the power of ideas, you know,
yeah.
Which actually turned out to be nonsense, because... in England, ideas have little importance.
Yes, when you were, when you were sort of young, he was past his novel writing phase was more or less over, wasn't it? He'd divert into things like World Brain, as you say. That sort of thing.
So in the 1920s, he turned towards these sociological subjects. Yes.
He also wrote his autobiography came out when you were about 10 or something, 12.
Well, I haven't read his autobiography. His last piece, The World, about world coming to an end.
World at the End of Its Tether.
Yes, that's the most appalling essay. World at the End of Its Tether, yes. That is a complete confession of the total failure of facts. You know? He had this tremendous thing about facts. Facts have worried people in the least.
Hmm.
People worry about myths and things, not facts.
I'm glad you're... So, I mean, am I right in saying that you have a dim opinion of conventional historians? I mean, if you're influenced by Morton and Wells, rather than people like Trevelyan, for example?
I was hearing about Trevelyan too, because he's very fashion in the 30s, people forget that. He was the fashion historian of the time.
With English social history, that sort of thing.
Yes, that had terrific sales. It's a very bad book, actually.
Well, yes, it's trash, isn't it, actually?
It's bunk, yes. But his history of England is also, I mean, he was a poor historian, but he had the measure of the English psyche at the time, and he was hugely successful.
Yeah. Well, okay, I've got to carry on here. 1939, E. Thompson finally supports Indians, it says here. People didn't realise that. I don't forget
this
where I
got it. His father, mark you.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. So, okay, well, E. P. Thompson comes later. Now,
but what Thompson objected to was the fact that the British government declared war on behalf of India without consulting the Indians. It's extraordinary cheek.
Yes, it is cheek. I actually can't think of, there was a chap yesterday at Ellis Hillman's memorial who was an Indian, who was a friend of Hillman, a friend of Ellis Hillman. He was saying he had a book with him on how Indians fought in the Second World War, which he'd written. I don't know if it was a good book or not. Anyway, never mind. Right, 1939-40, I've got you down to being at the RAF at Blyth. Mm-hmm. I think you mentioned that in passing. You didn't say much about what happened during the war.
I was in the SE Rescue Service, the coxswain and motorboats, high speed launches, out to save the blokes that got shot down over the sea.
So you were young, I mean, you were only about 18 or something.
20. I volunteered on the morrow of Dunkirk, but they wouldn't accept me for the Navy because half the Navy was in dry dock, being knocked about. People don't know, the Navy got a pretty severe hammering over Dunkirk. And a lot of the ships had to go into dry docks, so they wouldn't accept any volunteers. So I found that the RAF had this fleet of motorboats and the SE Rescue Service and joined that instead.
Hmm. You had a boating sort of interest or something?
No, I just wanted to be at sea and in small ships.
Right. You weren't a conscientious objector or anything?
Never.
No, right, okay. By the way, did you know that if you go to Dover, the tunnels overlooking, you know, above the White Cliffs, in which Churchill and so on operated, are now open. You can go and look.
Yes, I gather, yes.
Quite interesting. They've got some of the, you know, telephone exchanges and things there.
Yeah.
And in fact, they've got an ambulance. They've got a whole lot of underground ambulance, you know, hospital beds and emergency operating theatre things. Mm-hmm. But I think they were never really used very much in press. Anyway, let's see, right, 1940, Christopher Hill writes The English Revolution, 1640.
That's right.
I presume that was a 300th anniversary, in effect. I don't know if that's deliberate.
Well, first, of the Long Parliament, yes.
Yeah, right. Now, in 1941, I've got down here that there was an edition of the works of Gerard Winstanley, edited by G.H. Sabine. I think that was an American edition.
Sabine, yes.
Yes, Sabine. I mean, there were a few others since then, but I've picked up one for.
Yes, I've got that.
That'd be right. Was that the first, you know, edition for sort of years and years? Or have they been.
Well, you see, the disgraceful thing is that the English have never really published the works of the Levellers and the Diggers. He left to the Americans. And this is Sabine.
Yes, right.
No, this is Brailsford, great book. You see, this is a great modern classic.
I think Brailsford, yes. I remember you mentioning Brailsford on the Levellers.
I knew his wife.
The Levellers and the English Revolution. 1961. Right. And it was edited by Christopher Hill.
God, what a machine you've got there.
I know, it looks very impressive. It's just a domestic one. That's a
this is the same. Now you see.
Two volumes.
No, one volume.
Is it? What's the other one?
No, this is the Levellers.
Oh, right. Levellers Manifesto.
The Levellers Manifesto, done by Wolfe in America. See, now these have never been published in England.
That's true, really true to the present day. I did find an English book, but it was just extracts of Winston.
I mean, these two volumes are the key to this, the soul of England. And you have to go to America to get them.
Okay, I don't even know that in 1942 there was a book called The Pocket History of the British Working Class by Raymond Postgate, which was also illustrated by Horobin.
Yes, I remember Postgate.
I thought that was probably a forerunner of Thompson.
No, Postgate wasn't in the CP. He may have been in the 30s, but...
Well, I'm not saying it was in the CP, it was just the title of Pocket History of the British Working Class. It was kind of similar to...
Well, G.D.H. Cole, as he was writing, that was the main author about the history of the working class.
Oh, Cole, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And Margaret, his wife.
Yes, right. I've also got here, 1943, Jean-Paul Sartre wrote Being and Nothingness, but I don't know if that was translated straight away. and that added a general. I don't know how seriously he was taken, but he certainly introduced a sort of waffle component into the world.
Well, he wrote a rather good essay on humanism in the following year, or about 2 years later, I think, which was rather a very good study indeed, which was a bit of a modern classic. It's just a lecture, a pamphlet, first class. The trouble is he waffled. He's always in and out of the Communist Party, and couldn't make his mind up.
He was given a big boot by George Orwell, wasn't he? I think for Orwell said yes, he was going to give him a big boot. I think he wrote about.
He deserved a big boot.
Anti-Semitism, wasn't he?
A bit of
anyway,
a menace.
Right. Anyway, between 1945 and 1956, I've got down from somewhere. I don't know where this comes from, but Christopher Hill, E.P. Thompson, and Hobsbawm. I think you said they're in the Communist Party. That had. Technically true, that is.
Yes, they all were. Technically, very, very important. They founded the Historians Group, which I was a member of. That's where I met them all.
Right.
It lasted for 10 years.
Okay, and you were 10 years younger or something, or thereabouts.
Yes, I was 3 years older than Thompson, actually.
Oh, right. Oh, yes, Thompson was younger, but Hill was older, wasn't he?
Hill's older. Hill's still alive.
Yeah, well, so is Hobsbawm, isn't he?
Yes.
As far as I know. Okay, though. I don't know how interested you are in South Place. I've got his four typical titles. There was Radcliffe on a book called The Resurgence of Asia, a lecture on the resurgence of Asia, 1946. Mm-hmm. And Needham in 1947 on science and society in China. Mm-hmm. Then 1948 was Darlington on science, conflict of science and society. And then Lancelot Hogben, a thing called The New Authoritarianism, in which he kind of made fun of Darlington for some reason. It must have been an internal. I don't know if that kind of proves anything. That's just a sample out of the whole output of their book.
More lectures.
Yeah, their lectures, yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. 1949, Deutsch's book on Stalin was published as well, which I suppose proves something, I'm not quite sure what. Anyway, so that was, these things were going on. Now, in 1956, I've got down Khrushchev's speech on Stalin.
28th of February.
It was published. Next year, Sputnik. You mentioned that specifically.
The important thing to think about Khrushchev's speech, it was published in The Observer just a few days later. So this country was the only place which knew about the text of Khrushchev's speech shortly after it was made.
And it was in full, wasn't it, the whole thing?
Yeah.
A whole issue or something?
Whole issue, yeah. Extraordinary.
I don't know if it's impacted their sales or anything. Anyway, right, 1957, the Direct Action Committee was established.
Right.
Whatever they are, what did they do?
That's Hugh Brock and Pat Arrowsmith and Michael Randall.
Right.
They discovered Aldermaston, and they produced the famous CND symbol.
Yes.
And gave them both to CND, which was formed in January 1958.
The motivation was opposition to nuclear weapons, was it?
Yes, moral.
Right.
Ban the bomb.
When they say they discovered Aldermaston, you mean they... It became clear that it was
the
research
it,
centre and so on.
The AWRE, Atomic Weapons Research Establishment.
Okay, I mean, it didn't have signs pointed to it at the time.
It had AWRE on the front, but nobody knew what it was. It's the Direct Action Committee located it and publicised it.
Right. Anyway, next year, Nathalie, you went to an influential lecture which influenced you, by Dean Acheson.
Acheson,
right, on war with Russia and if nuclear weapons are... You know, as a slogan,
nuclear weapons equate conventional war decides.
Hmm. And you decided that nuclear war was not going to happen, or not likely.
That's right. And I was right. He was right. And I was right in believing him.
Okay.
So I didn't agree with Russell at all. I knew that the whole campaign was shallow. But it was the fashion, and good people were onto it, and it might lead somewhere. But it was all a chimera. There never was any danger of nuclear war.
CND, you mean?
And the Committee of 100.
Hmm. What about Cuba? That was like 62.
Right, and there was no bomb was dropped, you see.
Do you think, in fact, in retrospect, there was not much risk of that happening because the Russians were just not that strong? I mean, there was this mythology about the strength of Russia.
The Russians never intended to use the bomb. There was a section wanted to use the bomb against China.
Yeah.
That was the most serious danger of all.
Yeah, I was asking a different question about that, namely just the technology of it. I mean, maybe that they couldn't have, even if they'd wanted to, even if they'd wanted to, presumably they might not have been able to. That's all I'm saying.
No, they said they put the first bomb off in 1950, so they had the bomb.
Yeah, I know, but the delivery, you've got this ridiculous
delivery is a problem.
You've got this ridiculous for shooting. Anyway, never mind. Right, 1961. In fact, I don't know if this influenced you at all, but Fleming.
That was a critical year.
61. Fleming wrote The Cold War and Its Origins in two volumes. D.F. Fleming, does that ring a bell?
Doesn't I remember that book.
The Cold War and Its Origins, a very good book actually. I mean, he was the first person to start this train which led up to people like Chomsky and so on. Anyway, 1962, Vietnam solidarity.
Well, you mustn't skip in 51 over the Berlin Wall.
Okay.
And the murder of that African leader in the aircraft.
Lumumba.
Yeah.
Yes, I did skip. I'm not sure why. I think perhaps it was because your files were missing. Your wife destroyed them. I've got a gap from 50 to 55 for no particular reason. Maybe that's the reason. Anyway, okay, I've got down here 1962, Vietnam solidarity. What's your view about Berlin, by the way?
I predicted the war in print. In international, I was, a lot of course you've missed out, I was a founder member of the Socialist Labour League, the Trotskyist thing, and of International Socialism, the two main organisations for the recreation of Trotskyism after 56. And in the International Socialism, I predicted a serious crisis about to happen in Berlin. I didn't say it was going to be the war, it was going to be something very serious going to happen in Berlin. And it happened within months. And I've always, from that day onwards, said that the key thing is to bring the wall down.
You favoured unification of Germany?
Yes, of course. I wanted to see the Iron Curtain dissolved, which, of course, is Thompson's view eventually. That's why we created the END.
Okay. Well, anyway, I've got down here 1962, you were then Secretary of the Committee of 100.
International Secretary.
International Secretary, yeah, right. What does that actually involve?
Well, what happened was when Russell was imprisoned in 61. He got letters of solidarity from all over the world. So the committee set up an international subcommittee to cope with the correspondence, which was enormous. And the secretary was an American, but he went back to America in January, February 62. And at the Leeds meeting of the National Committee, the vacancy came up, and I offered to do the job and was accepted. So I became the secretary of the international subcommittee. And we did various important jobs, like setting up the first important demonstration in Moscow, in the Red Square.
Oh, really? So what happened when you got a letter expressing solidarity with Russell? You just write back and say, thank you.
Well, I wasn't doing the job then, you see. Oh, right. It was just 6 months before my time. But that was done. They built up a large number of names and addresses, you see, all over the world. It was a gorgeous opportunity to start an international movement.
I see.
Because of Russell's world standing, you see.
Yes.
That's how it happened.
Yeah. Do you think it's standing? Oh, well, never mind. I've got down here also 1962, The Age of Revolution. This was Hobsbawm's, I suppose it was his first major book, I don't know, 1789 to 1848.
Yeah.
Which I thought was very unsatisfactory, actually. I mean, the French Revolution is treated, it's just mentioned as a kind of, without any causes or anything assigned to it. It's just a revolution.
I've got a letter about that in the current New Statesman this week.
Really? But that book, or his treatment of the French Revolution?
His lecture last, when you mentioned.
Right.
He's trying to sell nationalism to the British, you know.
Was he?
Weird.
Anyway, 1963, E.P. Thompson's book comes out, The Making of the English Working Class.
Yeah.
Taken from all kinds of sources, including stuff nicked from his evening classes, I think.
Well, not nicked. He worked with his evening classes all over Yorkshire. He was lecturing in Leeds, you see.
Yes.
He went all over Yorkshire taking the evening classes, and he developed a lot of material which others haven't got about what had happened in the 19th century. He starts rather late, actually. He ignores the French Revolutionary period and begins rather late.
Yes, that's right. Okay. I think, is it? I remember reading a review, although I'm not sure if it was of this book.
Correction, I just made the wrong remark.
Did you?
He focuses on the 18th century and leaves out the late period. He doesn't deal with Chartism at all.
Oh, I see.
Which is a critical period for me, you see.
E.P. Thompson doesn't deal with Chartism?
No.
Oh, I see.
Left to do his wife, and she made a mess of it.
Dorothy Thompson.
Yeah.
That's rather silly, isn't it? perhaps he
wanted. I think it made it better. Because
is that because his book? I mean, by then, I mean, it was quite a hefty volume, wasn't it? So maybe.
Yes, but it tailed off by 1830, you see.
Yes. Did he mention? Did he say in that something to the effect that, you know, the working class created a culture which a king might envy?
Probably, because he believed in the historic role of the working class, which is some Marxist garbage, which he got from Karl Marx. See, this is why Marxism is now dead or dying, because it's just a silly myth.
About the working class being so wonderful. Yeah, okay.
I mean, I found out, my big discovery was in 59, when I was asked by the Trotskyist editor of Healy's newsletter.
Thierry Healy.
Yes, and to write a piece on the Aldermaston March, so I did. So being a Marxist still, of a kind, a sort of liberal Marxist, having been chucked out of the Communist Party, I said, what is the class composition of this march, comrade? And lo and behold, I was on my scooter, see, going up and down the march, as Peggy Duff's dispatch rider. And it didn't have any class composition. Well, if the Aldermaston March had no class composition, Marx was wrong. Absolutely wrong. Not a question of detail. His whole theory was mistaken. And as I inquired into the nature of the English Revolution, French, Russian, Chinese, they're all built on class alliances. Even Lenin declared the revolution cannot succeed unless the workers, the peasants, and the intellectuals get their act together. Which contradicts Marx completely. So, I mean, Marxism is fundamentally flawed. You know, absolutely wrong on its key thesis, which is the working class dictatorship. And that's what I got out of that.
Did you persuade E.P. Thompson of this?
No, Thompson hung on to this nonsense until he broke with it empirically. When the missile based crisis broke in 1679. Greenham Common or something.
Mm-hmm.
He threw himself, he abandoned his book on Blake, he's writing four books at the time, he abandoned them all, and spent about 5 years campaigning. He did 600 meetings, wore himself out, contracted a serious illness and tripped to India, and eventually withdrew. But he just dropped his Marxist theory without actually renouncing it.
Yes, I'm not sure.
Read his last book, Witness Against the Beast, about Blake. There's no Marxism there at all.
Okay. Right. Let's just go through that. I've got a few more dates. In 1964, Douglas Hume was foolish enough to go to the country on the bomb.
That's right. Saying that. People forget that.
Hmm. And he lost.
And he lost.
So it wasn't the fact his head looked like a skull.
No, he was... he was, in many ways, a very wise man, but... was not really a politician.
No, he would have been happier hunting things in Scotland.
Diplomat and a laird, yes, Scottish laird.
Okay, 1966, you wrote an article in Peace News on Britain starting the Vietnam War, which I've got a copy of here, and she's left over from previous visit.
Yes.
Peace News in their typical format.
Yes, that's since been confirmed by two television programmes.
Although you gave, as far as I can remember, you gave no sources. Was that from just taking...
My source was, I talked to the officer in charge of arming the Japanese.
The British officer?
Yeah.
Oh. Who was he?
Chairman of the... his name's in there.
Was it there?
He was chairman of the United Nations Association of Southampton.
Arming the Japanese.
He actually armed thousands of Japanese and turned them against the Vietnamese in order to restore the French.
That's, I mean, this is part of the... Have you... You must have looked into sort of revisionist stuff about the Second World War.
It's very important. It hasn't been properly done yet.
Yeah, I mean...
Very important subject.
I mean, there's all kinds of odd bits on there. For example, Clive Ponting wrote a book on 1940, didn't he?
Yes, I wouldn't trust him out of my sight, but on historical things, good on what he saw and experienced, but...
Yeah, I mean, he maintained, for example, the word Blitzkrieg. It's not actually a German word at all. It was, you know, the two separate component words exist, but the British... You know, both armies on both sides agreed that a lightning thing would be too dangerous. Then Hitler said, no, we're going to do this. And it worked, you see.
Well, so it was de Gaulle's idea originally.
Was it?
Yes. The combination of tanks and aircraft using the latest technology was de Gaulle's idea.
Moving as fast as possible from just kind of stuffing things.
Taken up by the Germans, not by the French.
Mm.
He was only a junior general at that time, isn't
he? No, the point I was making was that the British, having lost against this strategy, which they believed would not happen because professionals all opposed it, then had to invent a post hoc as a rationalisation for what happened. So they invented the word blitzkrieg to make it sound as though there was some completely new, like a weapon or something. You know. That was what.
Well, it was new. I mean, the combination of tanks and aircraft was new.
Mm.
See, we had our fighter command as a separate command. It wasn't part of the army.
Mm.
Now there was bomber command or coastal command. The Germans and the Russians fused their air forces and their armies in a single force.
Mm.
Now, we had a separate bomber command, which I was in. It's ridiculous.
So, I mean, there are, you do get these demarcation things, don't you? Like in the American, the
that's
USA.
That's right. It was extreme in England, you see.
Yeah. Right. Okay. 1907, Biafra started.
Yeah.
Chomsky wrote American Power and the New Mandarins, and Bertie Russell wrote a book, or had his book published, War Crimes in Vietnam, which was a collection of essays, really.
Yeah.
15 essays or something. I don't know what influence these things had. I mean, then Russell started his War Crimes Tribunal, which was kind of opposed.
Organised by Ralph Sherman, yeah.
Sherman and, yeah, various people like that. Vice, I think it was an American.
I wasn't involved with that.
Sartre as well.
He threw out the Vietnam Solidarity Campaign from their premises in London.
Yeah, I'll be telling you about Tariq Ali and so on.
Tariq Ali,
just
yeah.
For being, just getting in the way or something.
Well, they were a law unto themselves, and you know, Russell was a very imperial aristocrat. You couldn't argue with Russell. He just declared. You see, his word was law.
I
had a row with him too.
Yeah,
and. You know, and you either went along with him and obeyed him, or else you split.
Do you think that's what happened with one of his wife? I think it was his second wife or something. Dora said something very similar, that that she never actually argued with him at all on any intellectual matter.
That's right.
Because she thought that would just end their relationship. I just sounds wrong.
And Dora was onto a very important thing. She had discovered that Cartesian dualism was fundamental to our troubles, and Russell never accepted this, and she couldn't get it across to him, and I think she gave up. She spent 40 years writing a book about it. When she'd written a book about it, it was no longer news. Everybody knows Cartesian dualism is death. But Russell didn't know it.
She collaborated. In fact, she contributed a chapter to his book on Bolshevism in about 1920.
Did she, though?
Yeah.
She went there without his knowledge or permission.
Oh.
He was rather annoyed about that.
When it was reprinted, he took the chapter out. I think it was about the position of women in Soviet society. Yeah. She
was very loyal to him. I knew Dora quite well, you see.
Oh, really?
Because in the middle 70s, she thought that there should be a statue to Bertie somewhere in London, and there wasn't. So she contacted Fenner Brockway, and Fenner rang me because I was General Secretary of South Place, and Fenner was an appointed lecturer. And Dora had lectured for us. I knew Dora and Fenner quite well. And Fenner said, will you take it on and organize a fund, you see? So Freddie Eyre came in, Dora Russell, Fenner Brockway and myself. We met in the library in Conway Hall. I was the host. We worked out the whole thing. And Fenner was very persona grata with the Camden Council, you see. They think he's
gone. Labour
Council, still is. And so there's no problem about permission. Red Lion Square was given to us, you see. Which is outside my front door, because I was in the hall. So I raised about £5,000, and Freddie Eyre had a friend whose wife, he was Lord anyway, his wife was an American sculptor, and she did the bust, and it's there in Red Lion Square now.
Is it?
Oh yes.
In the middle of it,
at the far end. Fenner's at one end, and Bertie's at the other end.
I must have seen that without. I've just forgotten about it or something.
It's a bronze.
So that was your work. Well, that's very good.
I've got a picture. There's me, and Fenner, and Dora, and Freddie Eyre.
Gosh, you look. Isn't that bizarre? Eyre looks like George Brown with his glasses on.
He does, yes.
You look a bit more like. That's your Lenin cap.
Yeah.
Corduroy cap.
I'm still wearing it.
Yeah, right. That's good. Oh, right. Well, okay. It's just
I don't know.
1980. That's good. I'm kind of about that. She had another thing, didn't she? She was good on scientists. You know, she thought that it was that if scientists were so clever, they should have worked out a better way of doing things than have a balance of terror. Which is a fair comment.
Oh, I didn't know about that.
Yeah, that's the sort of thing that Russell would never say. You know, Russell was so much, he was instinctively on the side of academics, wasn't he, really?
Yes, he was a power man, really. He saw himself as a government in his correspondence with Khrushchev and Kennedy and so on.
Mm. Do you think it had any influence at all?
I think he had some guy, because he generated this enormous support for the Committee of 100, you know, around his name.
Do you think that would not have happened otherwise? I mean, they had people like J.B. Priestley, didn't they? But there was no very...
Priestley wasn't in the committee.
Oh, wasn't he?
No, just C&D.
Yeah. So without Russell, it would not have been...
There would have been... Sherman and Russell can cook the thing up, I assume.
Yeah, right. Okay, let's go on then. 1967, Russell denounces Israel as being imperialistic and that. 1968, Gabriel Kolko writes The Politics of War. This is about the Second World War, a revisionist bit of history. Very good book.
I don't know that book.
Well, it's, well, anyway.
American, is it?
Yeah, Gabriel Kolko. He's a professor of, I think it was Chicago or somewhere. Mm. He influenced Chomsky, quite important character. Okay, 1969, Nixon gives a speech on Biafra, which you went to. You applauded Nixon. Isn't that so?
No, Nixon landed here in the American base.
Milton
near Cambridge, Milton Hall, yes, and I went along to cheer him, and the police wouldn't believe me, first of all, because they thought we were going to be hostile. I persuaded them we weren't, and they let me through. And
do you remember anything of the content of his speech?
Well, he didn't write it, of course.
No.
But it was pro-Biafra, but he backed the British government effectively. Somewhere else. Anyway,
right.
The Americans might have been good, but they did nothing. It didn't press the British government at all.
Okay, anyway, let's just carry on here. I've got here 1971, Colin Wilson wrote The Occult. I put this in because I noticed you had a copy of it there.
Yeah.
1970s, right, Trilateral Commission was talked about.
It's still there.
With the Duke of Edinburgh and various others.
And they're practicing their main thing now. Their thesis was then, what do we do with our enormous amount of money? And the answer is, where is the cheapest labour force in the world? Answer is in China or Eastern Europe. So Western capital is pouring into Southeast Asia and Eastern Europe. We're closing down factories all over the place.
Yeah.
The trilateral thesis.
What are the three sides of the trilateral thing? Is that China...
Oh,
Russia and America or something. Europe.
Yes, I think so. I think it's Japan.
Oh, I see.
Europe and America.
Oh, I see, yes. Anyway, all right. 1972, Christopher Hill writes The World Turned Upside Down, so he's on his...
Yes, that's probably his best work.
Yeah. 1973, there are, you maintain, peaceful revolutions in Ethiopia, Greece and Portugal.
That's right.
Yeah.
I don't know about Ethiopia, Greece and Portugal.
Of course, a lot of Portuguese poured back from Africa, didn't they? From their colonies at some point here, having stripped all the assets from it.
Yeah.
Okay, 1970, Herman Kahn writes a book on Japan as an emerging superpower. Of course, he's written earlier about the atomic war, hasn't he? You know, mega deaths and so on in about the
yes.
early 60s.
Yes.
I don't know what influence that had either.
He's very influential chap in his time.
I think so.
A nice, interesting theory that the way to solve the world's problem is everyone to become middle class.
That was his idea.
There's something in it too, I'm afraid.
Right. 1974, I think it was, John Rawls, R-A-W-L-S, writes A Theory of Justice.
It's before 74.
Was it? I think you first mentioned it in 74. I don't know the publication date, which you regard as a landmark.
That's the most important book since the end of the war.
Is it?
Among philosophers, and it is a key work.
You know, Russell spent half his life agonizing because he thought there was internal conflict about ethics. He liked to believe that ethical judgments were kind of factual, objective, whereas everybody else, Santayana, persuaded him that they weren't. You know, in other words, you can't say anything useful about ethics. Do you take that view? I mean, do you think that ethics... I mean, from my point of view, I see a book John Rawls, a theory of justice. I just assume it's drivel, basically, because, you know, he'll just say this and that and the other. And,
oh, no, and Rawls is taken seriously. Yeah. Rawls's thesis is that the bottom line is self-respect. And the respect...
Did anarchism have any... Because there was a Spanish Civil War, wasn't there, when you were in your kind of youth? I mean,
I didn't come across anarchism until the Committee of 100.
Do you regard the Spanish Civil War as being anarchist? I mean, the Republic, was that not the way you look at it?
It was a crazy mixed-up thing, Stalinism and anarchism and social democracy. I haven't seen the film, but I think it's a pretty good account of what went on.
Oh, Ken Loach.
Yeah.
Mm. Right. Anyway, so you didn't devour Bakunin or any of these people?
No. Later, in 61, the anarchists Round Freedom Press decided to join the Committee of 100, which did it en bloc. So I met the anarchists all of a sudden out of the blue. At a very fertile moment, and I just split with Trotskyism and abandoned Marxism. So I met Nicholas in 62 and started to write for the Anarchist Press, and I have them ever since. I mean, I had a big bust-up last year with them. I wrote a piece on the Second World War, which they completely rejected, but they published it in their publication, The Raven. Well, I belong to the English radical tradition, starting with the Puritans, the Diggers, the Quakers, Thomas Paine, the Chartists, William Morris. That's my tradition, you see. And the Anarchist tradition is...
Isn't it largely Spanish? I mean, I thought it was, to some extent, it's...
No, it's Bakunin and Kropotkin and Malatesta. It's Russian, French, Italian and Spanish.
Yeah. I mean, it's partly...
It's largely Latin, you see.
Yeah, it's partly a genuine, kind of slightly naive thing against, you know, the authorities in places like Spain had little to be said for them. So it was just a kind of blanket opposition to the authorities that were there, wasn't it? I mean, it wasn't anything kind of philosophically subtle.
Well...
It's not a fair statement.
Bakunin spent a lot of time working on Spain and established roots there.
Yeah.
So that was the most mature place for anarchism in the world.
Okay. Let me just, when you were in the 1970s, you were in the, you were general secretary at South Place, weren't you?
Yeah.
And I looked through my files, I was a member of it then, I found a copy of their report for 74 to 75, 20 years ago, 22 years ago, something like that. And you said you gave 6 talks then, which presumably illustrate your interest. The case for a new Puritanism, freedom of speech and assembly, the long exile of the idea of justice, individuality.
Rawls.
Sorry?
That's Rawls.
Rawls, oh right. Individuality, status and hierarchy, and crisis in Red Lion Square, and also international humanism, report from Amsterdam. Sure. There was also a discussion on nostalgia with
indeed, yes, he lives in Kilburn. He's now Lord Russell.
Yeah. I think I've just erased something.
Peter's son.
He wrote on political... He wrote on...
7th century. He's an authority on the 17th.
Do you think... Have you read his book on...
I've got one of them here.
So, did you ever read it? It seemed to me just...
I haven't read it very thoroughly. No, I haven't, I must confess.
It seemed to be rather reactionary, for want of a better word. I mean, seems to have chucked away Marxism and all this kind of stuff. It's just back to looking at the kings and aristocrats and this kind of thing. Right. Let me just repeat. I think I just managed to erase something, actually. What were you talking about? Lenin. Lenin was important to you.
Yeah.
And then anarchism was not... You were not greatly interested by the Spanish Civil War, which was chaos.
No, I was too young. I was about 12, you see. No, I was 36. I was 15. But I was a late developer.
Yes, I think.
And I didn't really get going until I was 19. So I missed the Spanish Civil War because I was too immature to to read the papers, and furthermore I had very Philistine parents. You see, my mother and father, my father was in commerce, he was a managing director, but he had had no education, neither had my mother. They were both self-made, and there was no reading, and there was no writing, and there was no music. There was nothing in our household, I'm afraid. They were loving parents, but Philistines. So I got a late starting. I had to start all again about the age of 18, 19.
Did you shock them with your views?
Yes, my father threatened to sue me out.
Oh dear. What was his business, actually? What was his?
He was the managing director of a company which exported coal to Scandinavia and re-imported and imported timber, mainly pit props, for Newcastle.
Oh, right, Newcastle, yes. Okay. Let's go through your list of heroes. Okay, I've got down, I think you told me the following names. This may not be, I mean, it's not entirely serious. There's Blake, Bonhoeffer, Gandhi, Machiavelli, Martin Luther King, Nietzsche, Schweitzer, Tolstoy, and William Morris.
Yes, you can add Francis Bacon. The levellers and diggers to that.
Mm. Okay. Let's go through. Okay, Francis Bacon, yeah. Have you ever read Bacon?
Yes, extensively.
Really?
It's the greatest sin of English universities is their total neglect of Francis Bacon and their near neglect of Thomas Hobbes. They are the two founder philosophers of modern Britain, and they get shockingly ignored.
Yes, it's interesting. I read a book by a Baconian on Shakespeare, and he said that there was a copy, you know, the complete works of Bacon with the pages uncut in Oxford University, one of their libraries.
Is that right?
Yes,
oh,
I could get
them. Oh, God, that's typical. You can't buy the works of Bacon today. They're not published.
Well, they publish extracts, don't they?
Yeah.
It's not quite the same thing.
But all his works were published in the mid-19th century by a most enterprising chap, and they've all been not been republished for, I don't know, 60 years from then.
Hmm. How did you come across them? Or what led you to look at them?
Well, I had a friend called Peter Cronin, who was a lecturer in philosophy for Birkbeck, as I was. And we met as students, and then we met again after a 40 years lapse. And became quite close friends, and he devoted much of his life to try to restore Bacon in English universities.
He became an academic philosopher,
he was an academic philosopher,
or sort of historiographer of philosophy.
And but he'd also got a degree in English, and he tried to restore. And I got a lot. He believed, off the record, that Bacon wrote the works of Shakespeare, as I believe.
Hmm.
Because it's nonsense that a Stratford shopkeeper's son could write the works of Shakespeare. It's just absurd.
Yes.
We know nothing about Shakespeare. We've got on the back of a postage stamp. Whereas, I mean, we know a good deal about Bacon, and it all comes through in the plays and the poems. I mean, it's...
Do you think... I mean, you regard Bacon as a... Do you reckon as a sort of inventor of science? Or is that putting it too strongly? Just to
he did hardly any experimental work.
Mm, apart from stuffing a chicken with snow.
Oh, exactly, that's killed him.
Unless that's a myth.
No, I think that's true.
Or a legend.
But no, Bacon wrote the theory of inductive science, not deductive science. Inductive science, which means to say. A pretty abstract attempt, like Aristotle, to reconcile all the known evidence in some kind of recognizable theory. And Bacon did that. He studied everything. He's the last. Wells tried to do what Bacon. They tried to write an encyclopedia of all the world's knowledge.
Mm.
And Bacon, that was Bacon's objective. He never finished it, of course.
Do you think, in effect, he was influenced by the. He was trying to systematize the scientific side of the Renaissance, you know, with people like Torricelli and all that lot.
Yes.
Galileo. He was trying to make a British
version
of that.
He wanted to. He wrote his 58 essays, which are worth reading and rereading. They've never been out of print in 400 years. You know. His first essay on truth is a very important document for the whole of Britain. And he maintains the truth. It begins with the famous sentence. About Pontius Pilate. What is truth, said Pontius Pilate, and didn't stay for an answer. And people remember that bit, but not the rest of the essay, which is much more important, which says that truth is the ultimate yardstick by which you should judge everything. You see. And we've forgotten this. Today, the word truth is still regarded as a dirty word.
Mm. Do you think induction... I mean, that was attacked by Hume later, wasn't it, or something. I've always thought that induction perhaps is a, it was a bit of a red herring. I don't know if he actually used the phrase induction or inductive science.
No, but he was the inductive...
do you know if he used that phrase?
I'm not sure if he used the word, but his method was induction.
Okay. So Bacon, yeah, fair enough. Well, let's look at Blake. When I was here last, you discussed various things, about, for example, Blake at the Tate Gallery in a badly lit room with terrible presentation.
Yes, still bad.
And whereas, as opposed to, for example, Picasso in Barcelona. And you took out your limited edition £100 slipcase volume, I've got down written here.
Yes.
About 12 inches by 18. I don't know if it's correct, I just jotted that down.
The Tate's done a very good job since, by the way. They've published a long series of...
Sorry, who did?
The Tate. They've done a great deal to...
Oh, right.
They cost £48 each, which is a bit of a snag.
And what else happened? The Japanese are keen on Blake. He's the only artist in history who did poetry as well. Every US college has a course on Blake.
Yeah,
the Blake Quarterly.
We have next to nothing.
And you have a Blake Dictionary by Bindman, is that right? Blake Dictionary by Bindman.
I
think I've got it as Bindman.
No, not Bindman. Bindman wrote a book, another book.
Oh.
This is the Blake Dictionary. My copy is falling to bits. Right. Foster Damon.
Foster Damon, D-A-M-O-N. Right.
Yeah.
That's dated 1965 originally.
The XCP is very important. The X Committee of 100 is important. The X Green Party is important. Any number of X parties in England, and they are very strange and very, very important indeed. People have created relationships, and the organisations have collapsed, but the relationships, of course, have not collapsed. So Nicholas led to me this morning, that dates back 1962.
Right, okay. Let's continue with Blake. There's all the stuff about his artistic work and so on. His house, which I think was not made into a
that's his flat
museum.
We wrote Jerusalem.
Where is it?
South Milton Street.
South Milton Street. Oh, I do have that note on that. Yes. Is it the same building? I mean,
yeah.
Similar building.
On the first floor.
Probably won't last very long, then, will it?
No, it's very high value property now.
It's a lifetime. Oh, the Blake Dictionary. Yes, I spoke to Ellis Hillman. He said that loss just means soul. The sun.
Yes, probably.
I've got a note here saying, I explained it could be done more quickly with a computer, like a concordance. And I explained about the Society of Indexes. He hasn't heard of them, looks interested as I explain why indexes are so often bad. I don't know if that rings a bell with you. But, I mean, nowadays, if somebody wanted to do a Blake dictionary, you know, with computers, you can do a kind of superior job, in principle, anyway.
Took him 40 years to write that.
Yeah. You've got another thing about Blake. This is quoted from an Ethical Record article. The climactic expression of antinomianism. Nomos is the law, and it's not made clear, as far as I can see, whether you mean the legal system or sort of some natural law or something. And you go back to the 17th century to examine the tradition of antinomianism, the Diggers, Winstanley, Ranters, Quakers, Muggletonians, Universalists.
Yeah.
And you also find England's very last Muggletonian. I don't know whether... do you agree with that? I mean, does
Blake, yes, very much, you know, so.
By antinomianism, what do you mean by law in that sense, with a capital L?
Nomos means authority. The law of morals, the law of property, the law of the state...
Well,
the law of top people given to the people and enforced by coercion.
You're using law in the ordinary legal sense, in other words, are you?
Well, no. Blake was very hot against the moral law. He hated the Ten Commandments and this kind of thing.
Okay, by the moral law?
Life is not like that. Life is... Blake said, man is made for joy and woe, and when this you rightly know, then through life you safely go. He's about... joy and despair, about brotherhood
and forgiveness, and about truth and untruth, self and the negation of the self. He came to the conclusion at the end of the day that the most important thing was the annihilation of selfhood.
Did he annihilate himself?
Yes.
In fact, he had no kids, did he?
So he was a very bad PR man.
I seem to remember that he wanted to have a child by another woman, but his wife was not enthusiastic.
Well, I don't know about the child, but he said he wanted to have an affair.
Oh, I see. Hmm. I see, maybe that's a... Yeah. Let me, when I spoke to Ellis Hillman, he told me he was interested in Blake and Fuseli and all these people. He told me that, this is what Ellis Hillman told me, I don't know if they agree with it, it was an interesting point of view, that the Gordon riots were a sort of revolution which were more important really than the French Revolution, you know, with Newgate corresponding to the Bastille and so on, and that in effect German mercenaries were used to crush them, you know.
Well, the trouble is, the Gordon riots, people agree, Dickens got it wrong, you see.
Barnaby Rudge.
Barnaby Rudge is got it completely wrong. What happened was, Lord George Gordon was a naval officer who served in the West Indies and in the southern states of America, which were then, of course, British. And he was strongly pro the colonies, pro the British in America. And in the late 1770s, the British government was very hard up to get troops. They'd hired a large number of Hessian mercenaries because they couldn't get British troops. And one of the reasons why they couldn't get British troops is they couldn't recruit Catholics. Because
yeah,
they were barred from the army by the Test Act.
Yes, you mean it was illegal to.
So he wanted, what the British government was, amend the Test Act to induce an element of toleration which enabled the Catholics to join the army. Then they could be called up as part of the militia, which they were. So Gordon planned this demonstration in defense of the American colonies. And it took an anti-Catholic, because it was about Catholicism for quite different reasons to do with the recruitment to the army. It was taken up by the English. I don't like the word mob, but it's probably as good a word as any. As an anti-Catholic demonstration. You know, down with the Pope, rather like Paisley in Northern Ireland. And they broke into embassies, emptied wine cellars, got drunk, and the whole thing got out of hand.
Why should Gordon have wanted it? I don't follow that.
He was a pro-American. He fought in favour of the colonists, and the government was legislating over Catholics to get the Catholics to join the army to crush the Americans.
Okay, you're saying that it was... He didn't want the George III to fight the Americans.
That's right.
Hmm.
Like Burke.
And Pitt as well, of course. That's right, isn't it Pitt?
Burke.
No, Pitt wasn't the Prime Minister, Pitt.
Chatham. Chatham was earlier. No, the Prime Minister was Lord North.
Right. Yes, Ellison also had this business about Fuseli. You know, there's one of Blake's etchings or engravings. I can't remember which it is. There's actually a picture of the, I think it's of Newgate or something like that, with Gordon in it. Or there, a portrait of him. And he. Ellison was saying there's a connection between Fuseli being both Turk and Jew, you know that phrase, with a Jewish cult leader called Zevi. I've forgotten the details, actually. I should have looked this up more thoroughly, shouldn't I? Perhaps that means nothing to you.
I don't know that story. I should know, but I don't. I'd like to know more about Fuseli.
When he said Fuseli was both Turk and Jew, you know the quotation about the only man I ever knew who didn't make me... I can't remember, something like almost spewing anyway, except for Fuseli, who was both Turk and Jew, and there was some relationship with the Ottoman Empire, I think.
Yeah.
No big deal. You mentioned Bonhoeffer, Gandhi, Machiavelli and Martin Luther King without any great detail, just as kind of great figures. Do you have any comments on those?
Well, Machiavelli is part of the English blindness, that the English only know his little book on the prince, which is not his important work. His important work is his discourses on Livy, which gives his personal philosophy and his personal politics. And he was an advanced liberal. But people take his few remarks he made about the prince. He simply described what princes actually do. The princes are completely ruthless people, because they have to be. If they're not, they get put to death, as plenty were. As he gives an accurate description of the political realism which obtained at the time.
What has Livy got to do with it? Like you just said, my philosophy or something.
Well, he takes Livy as his starting point, as Livy talked about moral things too.
I see. What's your view on Gandhi? I mean, I presume one of the reasons that Gandhi is popular in Britain is because he didn't oppose. His opposition was not very vigorous to the British.
Gandhi's...
You can afford to have the high opinion of him.
We had a seminar on Saturday with the Gandhi Foundation.
Oh, really?
I'm an executive officer of the Gandhi Foundation, responsible for Northern Ireland, which is my main political thing for the last 8 years. Gandhi was... Blake was... He said, don't touch politics, it all stinks. And was very fierce about this.
Did he include that? I mean, with Paine, when he was dealing with Thomas Paine, he gave him political advice, didn't he? Like,
yes, to leave the country immediately. Yes. Yeah. So the story goes. Well, that's pretty good advice, because if he hadn't, he would have been imprisoned or hanged.
Why don't you count Paine as one of your great men, or you just kind of overlooked him or something?
Paine, it comes in the leveller tradition. Paine was... He had no revolutionary ideas about society or economics. He was a... There was a very powerful liberal tradition centered on a man called Major... Major... Anyway, the notion is that the English yeoman, who has been wiped out by the Enclosure Acts, by the way, now no longer exists, but the English yeoman, the English master craftsman, the English journeyman, the English apprentice, the small businessman, the craftsman, is the heart of England. Now, Paine accepted that and thought the system could be made to work if it was democratically organized. He invented the notion of the welfare state. Thought there should be pensions and sick benefits and unemployment benefits and so on.
Did you use the expression yeoman in its, you know, the present sense? Like people in the archers, a stout yeoman.
A yeoman is an English peasant who has 100 acres, a stone-built house, 2 pistols and a sword.
Yeoman, it sounds with you. They used to pronounce you as yo, didn't they? It means somebody who happened to have a you as well, a sheep.
Let's look it up and see what it says. I never actually looked the word yeoman up.
Yes, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I mean, I take your point about Paine. You're saying that he wasn't.
He was a revolutionary in the sense that he wanted to overthrow tyranny. He regards himself as a. The world is my church, you know. He fought the brotherhood of man.
Well, he also disliked religious. Absolutism.
Yes, he was against dogmatic religions and churches. But he was a deist. He wasn't an atheist, he was a deist. Newman. I've never looked this up before. What an interesting idea.
Yes, well, don't get too excited. It's only the Concise Oxford.
It's a very important book, is the Concise Oxford. No, it means, it says, human, probably young man.
Fair enough.
Tells us nothing.
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Should I put that back? I interrupted you in the middle of Gandhi. The Gandhi Society.
Well, see, people could talk about values and freedom and lose as the levellers and the diggers lost at the end of the day. And Blake lost, and Godwin lost, and the Chartists lost. There had to come a time when someone would come along who would devise a method of political action and structure which would actually win. And the conjunction of values and ideas with action had to await Tolstoy Schweitzer, and Gandhi. They were the first three, effectively, because Morris tried but failed. He resigned eventually.
William Morris?
Yeah, destroyed by the anarchists. Poor lot they were. They still are. But Tolstoy, you know, secured the transfer of this large population from Russia to America, where they are now. These people with the funny names who strip naked for demonstrations.
Dukhobors.
Tolstoy got them out. He organized famine relief. He went back to the land himself, made his own shoes. He tried to practice what he preached, but of course the odds were too great. But they couldn't touch him because he was more popular than the Tsar. He wrote to the Tsar. The Tsar, I don't know. But he tried, you see, and Schweitzer did the same. He was a principal of a theological college. He gave it all up, went back to college in his early middle age, became a medical student, qualified as a doctor, went out to Lambareni to found a hospital. He thought Europe was finished. He had to go back to the beginning and start again. You know? Action. And Gandhi likewise, in the same period, he saw that you had to stand up against injustice, and his wife and their friends in Johannesburg invented nonviolent direct action, because the South African government declared that all their sons and daughters were bastards.
Did they really?
Yeah.
How come? Because they were mixed race or something?
Because their marriages weren't recognized in South African law. And there were demonstrations on the streets by the women in Johannesburg about 1910 or thereabouts, and that's how direct action was born. Political direct action. I mean, there'd been strikes, of course, which are industrial direct action for generations.
They had a Hindu marriage or something like that, you mean, whatever it was.
Well,
I'm not doing
however, it. How it was done, they wanted to drive them out of South Africa and drive them back to India, you see.
So they just...
They declared that they weren't legally married, all their children were bastards, and this was a terrible thing to say to the women of South Africa.
It's a bit like the Normans, isn't it? If you didn't accept, after the Norman invasion, you have to accept Norman marriage.
That's right, the harrying of the North is the most terrible event that's ever happened in this country. People don't know about it, you know.
That's curious, isn't it? How it shows.
I mean, I come from the North, you see, and there are no medieval villages in the North. Not a bit like the South, unless it happened to be a church or a monastery there, or a castle. It is, you know, there's nothing there. Northumberland, Durham are empty of medieval objects except connected with the Norman church and state. It's a shocking thing. They wiped up, well, I don't know if you know about this, but when the Normans invaded, they sent a small posse up to the northeast to occupy them. The Saxons rose and they massacred all the Normans. So William got an army together and went up and massacred all the Saxons. And they're not in the Domesday Book. There's not a single village or town recorded the Domesday Book of the North East because it didn't exist. He wiped the bloody lot out.
It is curious how historians are so subservient.
I mean, I still break out in a sweat when I think about it, because it was such a terrible thing to do. And I mean, I have mixed feelings about Durham Cathedral and the castle there. They're a magnificent building. But it's also the most terrifying building in England. If you go into Durham, have you ever been to Durham Cathedral? Those pillars. You know, they are standing examples of absolute authority, total mastery. We are the boss. Like it or I'll kill you, you bastard. You know?
Those hefty great stone things.
There's no humanity in that building at all. It's all authority.
You have to be careful with interpreting cathedrals, don't you? Because a lot of them have been derelict from time. I mean, the church authorities don't emphasise this point. A lot of them have been derelict and destroyed from time to time. And, you know, you can't assume that what you see is what's, you know, has any sort of genuineness at all.
No, I think Durham is well preserved. It's an original Romanesque monument.
That's what they make out of it. Yeah, okay, that's interesting. Yes, there's a similar thing with to Montfort, isn't there? I mean, he went and massacred all the people in the south of France. I forget what they were called.
And that's the previous, that's his father or grandfather, of course.
Really? Well,
don't mix him up with Simon de Montfort, for God's sake.
Well, you're saying they're related to William the Conqueror?
No. There are two de Montforts.
Yeah, well, several.
One conducted the crusade against the
Albigensians.
That was in the 1820-25 period. And Simon de Montfort led the revolt against Henry III over the Sicilian affair in the 50s, 25 years later.
Sorry, you're talking about which century?
12th, 13th.
Right, okay. Yeah. Anyway, I mean, well, I don't know, I can't look into it, but surely one of the de Montforts, if not both of them, had a record somewhat similar to harrying of the North.
Yes, that's the first de Montfort, right?
Mm.
Brutal crushing of the Albigensians. Yeah.
For money, presumably.
No.
I think they were
Gnostics, you see. They didn't belong to Rome at all. It was quite a separate Christian church.
We should talk about this later, actually, whether there's your views on economic determinism. Let's just go back to this list of eminent people. As Nietzsche was the other one
who's
written about.
Nietzsche is the man who, like Blake, understood that the bottom line in humankind is genius. We've all got a bit of genius. Every living human being got a bit of genius. If he hadn't got it, he'd be a bloody gorilla.
Hmm.
And our people won't recognize this because it means a certain freedom of the human spirit, because genius can't work otherwise. And this means the absence of control and the lapse of a hierarchy.
Okay, by genius, you don't mean in the genius loci sense of just something that happens to reflect what's going around. You mean?
No, not at all. No, it means it means originality.
Right, yeah. Okay, and you also had a view about Nietzsche and tragedy, that comedy is the art form of the working classes. I don't know.
Well, yes, Nietzsche taught that tragedy is the death of nobility. And if there's no nobility, there's no tragedy.
You mean killing off the plebs isn't a tragedy?
That's right.
Hmm. What's that?
If you kill off the great souled ones, that is tragedy. But they die in their struggle for human values.
Is that related to comedy being the art form of the working class? Was that just
yes, well, when the Athens had been defeated in the Peloponnesian War by the Spartans, the aristocrats lost control of the state. It handed over to the plebeians and the up-and-coming people, and they put Socrates to death.
But there's only one
the
event.
Death of Socrates is tragedy, you see.
Hmm. But that doesn't follow from that throughout the whole of the rest of history, all working classes should have a characteristic art form of comedy.
No, what happened was that, see, there are no more tragedies written after the Peloponnesian War. The new art form is comedy, and the notion is to entertain and to make people laugh.
I see what you mean. I hadn't understood what you were saying. Yes, I'll take your point.
The four great tragedians, from Aeschylus onwards, they come to an end, you see.
Right, well, at least that's the stuff that survived. An awful lot of Greek stuff didn't survive.
Yes, that's right.
Mm. There's an interesting point made. I came across a reference in an essay by Jode, who was not a great thinker or anything, but he said that Nietzsche was, I haven't got the quotation here, which perhaps I should have done, that Nietzsche is in the highest degree obscure and convoluted, and even people who've spent their lives studying him don't have great difficulty interpreting him.
That's absolute rubbish.
You think that's true?
He writes brilliantly and clearly.
Mm.
You have to read him carefully, but Nietzsche is an absolutely splendid writer.
He also said that before the First World War, Nietzsche had fallen so out of favour in Germany that a German who wanted to lecture on beyond good and evil had to send to England for a copy. You heard that story, haven't you?
Well, that's quite possible. He wasn't. Nietzsche had to publish his own work, like Blake, you know. Like me, I had to publish Direct Democracy myself. Nobody would touch him.
I suppose that's true. I hadn't thought of that. He spent the last 20 years of his life, Nietzsche, wandering around, kind of stateless or something.
He was a bit more successful towards the end. He got a publisher and so on. But, of course, he went mad. And I have a theory, because it's just a romantic theory in a way, that it wasn't tertiary syphilis that killed him, that's the normal view. He took on the world single-handed. I didn't break anybody's brains.
Hmm. Do you think he actually went mad? Or
oh, yes.
You know, not in a proper sense.
Schweitzer met him. Not Schweitzer, the founder of the Theosophists.
Annie Besant.
No, the other one, the man who founded the thing.
Oh, yes.
He met him in 1895. describes it in a book, and he lay on the bed there, and he didn't speak, or hardly spoke, or said, "It's a nice day," or something, and that's all he could say. His brain had gone. He's a non-person for the last... He died in 1900, and the last 11 years of his life looked after by his sister. He was dead, effectively. And, you know, he died trying to save a horse from being whipped.
Why do you count him amongst your list of heroic writers?
Well, he's the man who got it right, you know.
Which bits did he get right? Sorry to label
that point. He got the state right, he got individualist creative right, he got most things right. He had certain blind spots. But then, I don't expect people to be pure and perfect.
What did he say about the state?
He hated the state.
Right.
Wanted it abolished.
He was Polish, wasn't he, come to think of it?
He claimed to be Polish. He was German.
Oh,
but he was so appalled by the Germans and by their anti-Semitism that he left Germany, went to live in Paris, and thought that Paris and Italy were the only places, and Switzerland, where he worked, of course, where civilized life was possible. Wouldn't go back to Germany, and tried to deny his own German parentage.
Did he change his name or anything to make it sound Polish?
No. But he claimed to have Polish ancestry.
How did he manage to support himself? I mean, I've seen his...
Well, he was a lecturer at Bâle, and he had this peculiar disease, you know. He wasn't very well. And when he was in his late 30s, they gave him a life pension.
Oh, really? Expecting his life to be short, possibly.
Possibly, yeah.
Yes, he was a linguist, wasn't he? Or a philologist or something.
Philosopher, yeah. Classicist.
Well, philologist, I mean, investigated language, didn't he? Etymology, that sort of thing. Sanskrit, you know. I mean, I don't know.
I'm not sure.
I think that's what etymology...
I think he lectured in classics, but that was probably a language thing, too.
There was something else about Nietzsche. I've forgotten it. Okay, well, so that's your list of kind of hero figures. I've got a list here of, in alphabetical order.
And there's some modern hero figures that I haven't mentioned, like John McMurray.
John McMurray?
Yeah.
Never heard of John McMurray, I don't think.
Oh, Britain's most important philosopher.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
What did he say? Well, wait a minute. Can I wait for a minute and discuss philosophy? Because I've got a separate sort of section on philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just jot down John McMurray. Let's go through your whole list of topics in kind of alphabetical and otherwise random order. Okay. First one here is Bentham.
My arch-hate figure.
Your arch-hate figure, yeah. Along with Sidney Webb, the biggest disaster I've got here.
Oh, yes.
Bentham, he invented modern managerialism, destroyed
Bentham,
socialism.
Bentham, Sidney Webb, Mrs. Thatcher. That's the series. Villains.
The Lenin of England, you said.
That's right.
You also said he was a saint in France. I think
yes. Taken as the model for the law of Napoleon.
Was it really? Ah. His body's in a case at UCL. In fact, I saw that as a great big thing.
Yes, I've had tea with him.
You've had tea with him?
Yes, when the university lecturers have a tea, we meet and they open the big box.
Oh, do they?
And he'd have tea with Bentham.
He went to Oxford at 13. He had a piano in every room. No wonder he was into punishment. His central theme was prisons. This is what he said. And then 1825 to 50, he captured...
No, his central theme was rationalism.
Yeah. Redrafted the law of England.
Disciples did.
Right, a strict routine. I think you meant, or I think I interpreted you to mean that he worked out his things and then chipped away at them one at a time.
No, he rose in the morning, certain. He had morning, afternoon,
right,
evening,
right.
Tea, dinner, everything organised, spot on. He knew where he was, you know.
Right. So there's nothing to do with the sequence. I mean, I've got a list of laws and acts, the Poor Law. The Municipal Corporations Act, the Master and Servant Laws, Bankruptcy, Bank Charter, Law of Contracts, Law of Tort.
Yes, the Benthamites are behind all that, and the Factory Act. They took control of England.
Ah, right, you're saying those are the laws that they introduced, not the ones they got rid of.
Introduced, yes, but what they had to get rid of was mercantilism and the Corn Laws. And the whole business of... monopolies to the East India Company.
Were they influenced by Adam Smith, do you think?
Well, Adam Smith was the founding father of it all. Free trade as against protection. That's the theme. Or the middle classes against the aristocracy. You see, what Bentham and Co. hated was the landed aristocracy and the gentry running the country, as they had done for hundreds of years since Henry VIII put them in power, effectively, by handing over the lands of the monasteries.
So what was the net effect of, for example, the poor law, the municipal corporations, and so on? You're saying these all strengthened...
They strengthened the middle classes. They enabled the middle class to take over.
Okay, they enabled the middle class to rule the poor, presumably, to control the poor.
To run the country.
To have municipal corporations.
They displaced it. England had been ruled by craft guilds and common councils based on craft guilds and merchant guilds. And they were all abolished except the City of London. So the whole government of England was transformed at the urban level by the Municipal Corporations Act, which people forget.
Well, don't know. I mean, I've never heard of it.
Well, 1835.
It says that it destroyed all the charters and gave towns their independence.
That's right. So every town was treated the same. See, now, under the English system, every town was different, like every village. Instead of handling the thing intelligently and saying, now, this town's got such and such which are right or wrong, and change them, the whole lot, blanket transformation, like introducing comprehensive schools regardless. Now go look at the trouble we're in. You mustn't do blanket reforms. You must take account of diversity and spontaneity, and then it'll work. I do hate blanket reformers.
Previously, governments were in the hands of 24 companies, is that right? There was no democracy, but there was a sort of accountability. You could.
It was ruled by the masters of the guilds, you see.
Are you sure that's true? I mean, is it...
There was no other government in the town.
Do you have a... Is there a literary... I mean, if you read people like Defoe or something of that time, or Richardson or something, you don't get a picture, at least I can't remember, I mean, you don't really get a picture of an England ruled by, you know, guilds and so on.
In the towns, at least, but not in the country.
Is that because... I mean, all I'm saying is that it doesn't seem to reflect... if you read Dickens, you can see stuff about bankruptcy and so on.
Dickens was writing after the...
I know, but if you... get a corresponding writing before, you don't seem to get the sort of picture that you're describing. That's what I'm saying. It doesn't seem to come across that way. I mean, in Shakespeare, that's a lot earlier, of course, but there's virtually nothing about guilds in Shakespeare's writing, I remember.
Well, he doesn't write about the towns.
Well, I'm just
he
saying...
He writes about the aristocracy.
Okay, well, I'm just saying, if you look between the time of so-called Shakespeare and between and up to 1835...
If you look at the English Civil War, each town... had to decide whether it's for the king or for parliament, and they keep on changing their minds.
Yeah.
And they were governed by councils of 21.
Why is there no reflection of that in novels? Perhaps was it too early for novels or something?
Well, the novels come of the English ethos is based upon what the landed gentry were thinking and doing.
If you read Tom Jones or something, that's not much in there. I suppose there are small towns don't figure very much.
Well, Tom Jones again is about the countryside, isn't it? Long time to rip.
And Jane Austen as
Jane Austen's all about the countryside.
This is true.
It's all about big houses. I'm getting a bit fed up. I'm getting a bit angry about this treatment as though there's nobody else in the bloody world except the gentry.
Yes, it's just tiresome, isn't it? So it could just be that novelists didn't bother to write about Birmingham. Well, they weren't. I mean, towns were smaller, weren't they?
The bourgeoisie have always been despised. You know what trade is? You see, trade is akin to slavery. It's a... you're not a proper human being if you're in trade, for God's sake. And yes, that's what dominated the town, was trade, industry and craft. Each town had its market square, and round them were the craftsmen in their workshops and their merchants and so on, and their fairs.
On the face of it, fairs, of course, were granted by the king. I've never quite understood charters. Really.
Charters also granted by the king.
I presume that the idea of a charter is that you're allowed to have a fair, but...
You're allowed to govern yourself under a charter. You're given the power to govern yourself. Yeah,
well, presumably there's a quid pro quo. You have to pay the king
a couple of quid.
It's
a token fee you pay them.
Are you sure it was that token? I mean, they were very carefully controlled, were they? Fairs?
No, the important thing was the taxes imposed through Parliament. See, from Simon de Montfort's day, there was a Parliament in England. He invented it.
Parliament of whom?
Of two from each town, two from each county. And the reason why they were called, it was called the High Court of Parliament. It didn't govern the country in any sense. It was told, and the main thing was to get was the taxes. And the taxes came through what are called tenths and fifteenths, which are the forms of taxes took on turnover. And of course the wool staple. Every port had a collecting function to collect tax from wool exports.
Well, and also other things too, didn't it? Was that later?
Other things too.
They had smuggling.
But it was called the wool staple because the main commodity was wool. Yes, other things, smugglers, imports of wine especially.
Right, so, okay, so your view is that in 1835 all this was done away with. Basically, I mean, it's not entirely an Adam Smithy thing, is it? Because I presume according to Smithism, you'd favour competition. I mean, there's no particular reason why you should have just one overall legal system, even, is there? So it's not really Adam Smith, it's something else. It's to do with maybe the...
No, it's to do with free trade. You see, the craft guilds, the big cities weren't built in the old towns because the old towns wouldn't change.
I see what you mean. Like Stamford.
So Birmingham, where it had no craft guilds,
Like Stamford is a classic case, isn't it? Stamford has not changed since...
The old medieval towns, like Lincoln and Exeter. Exeter was a bit different because they had the wool trade was big in Exeter. My daughter lives there. But you can go around now, the county towns, I mean, look at Hexham and Morpeth and Anakin.
Buckingham,
a very good example. And they're all stuck to their rigid self-control. You're not going to have a factory here because we're not going to allow it, you see. So the craft guilds hang on. And so the industries have got to go to other places. They go to the valleys of Lancashire and Yorkshire. But there's water, you see. You want to have water to turn the mills.
This is related. It's often said that contracts replaced something else. Association, I forget what the expression is. Is this the sort of thing you mean? Is this the sort of thing they're talking about?
That's right. Law of contract is very important. Yeah. It's also connected with, you see, the Bankruptcy Act was probably the most important thing, and the Companies Act. Limited liability companies. This was, 1852?
It's a bit later, yeah.
This is critically important because now you weren't liable for the debts of your company if you went bust.
Yeah, it was after the South Sea Bubble, wasn't it, or something?
Like no, that was 150 years earlier.
Well, some sort of event like that made them... I mean, there was a book by the chap who founded the SD... the Social Democratic Federation,
Henry Heinemann.
A book by him on... economic crises in the 19th century, which is kind of related.
The big one, 1825. So it was 300 or 500 banks went bust.
I still don't quite see what's the generating thing here. I mean, it's just maybe it's just the
generating thing is profit.
But it's also the Industrial Revolution. I mean, you have to have a system in order for all this to come into place. There has to be the potential for it to work. I mean, so maybe it's just a reaction to things like. To industrialism, to the steam engine, and to the fact that railways, the fact that it's technically possible to do these things.
That's right. Yes, the technical thing is very important. Because
is it possible if the guilds and so on had been a bit less sticky in the mud, that they might have been still there?
Yes,
now?
Indeed. I mean, the London guilds survived the present day. But if you join the grocer's company, you're probably an architect, you see. I mean, anybody can join them now if you've got enough money and pull. But about 90 of them, you see.
But they could, in principle, if they'd have been a bit more.
But now they're charitable foundations. But they do government city. 32 boroughs and the City of London, you see.
32 boroughs and the City of London. Is that what we've got now?
Yeah. Since 65.
I see what you mean. So how do you think, suppose Bentham hadn't existed, utilitarianism hadn't existed, what should have happened?
We've gone on being like Ireland. Country villages, small towns.
Well, or France, presumably. France was...
Well, France had a different view of centralised authority and building up Paris. So,
I thought the point about France was that geographically it's got such a variety of... I mean, you've got quite a lot of fish and quite a lot of wine and quite a lot of agriculture, quite a lot of land.
That's right.
So they never bothered to... They weren't kind of interested in... I mean, they were the original... Were they mercantilists, the ones that believed in...
Yes, but from Louis the 14th day, they took a big interest in commerce, you see.
You mean commerce as opposed to industry, trade rather than actually making things?
Well, no, the French tapestry industry was quite big. And glass.
Oh, that's right, Dinanderie, they had brass manufacturers in the Middle Ages, didn't they?
They were deliberately encouraged by the government. They had this tradition of centralisation, which we don't really have here, you see.
I thought there was this geographical thing, that they've got such a range of...
No, it's got to do with Roman law, I think. You know, the Roman law obtains in France and Italy, and it doesn't obtain here. We've got a case law here. We don't have a listed laws.
So there's no abstract principle you can appeal to, is that the idea?
Well, the abstract principle is the principle of justice, which is higher than law.
Well, is that really... I mean, I would have thought the main importance of law is to, you know, mark this sense. Well, I mean, it has several different functions, but one of them is just to maintain the ruling class. I mean, if you're
that's
rich...
Right, that's right, that's right, that's right. But it's not only that. I mean, you can defeat the government. The government's been defeated many times in recent years in the law courts.
Yes, right.
Because the judges hold that certain things are more important than the confusion over existing law.
So basically that's your vision of England. It's a bit like William Morris.
Yes, a lot of time with Morris. But Morris, of course, didn't understand or didn't like modern technology. So his vision of the news from nowhere is essentially a village craft economy.
That's right. Well, I mean, he'd like, as an artist... If you're an artist, you've got a problem, haven't you, really? I mean, since photography was invented, for example, that more or less introduced technology into the visual arts, didn't it?
Yes, what he didn't understand was you can't do any of these things until you've abolished poverty. And we have to create poverty, you've got to create surplus, you see? And what modern technology does is create the possibility of surplus.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. Yeah, that's right. Well, it doesn't have to be modern. I mean, any technology would say...
Well, the Chinese stopped technology deliberately in order to maintain the power of the Mandarins in the 12th or 13th century.
They stopped. They had a large.
They had a considerable scientific revolution
and a sea power as well, didn't they?
Yes, and they could have had done enormous things, but they stopped the lot dead.
Do you have evidence for that? I
mean,
that
there's a huge work by our friend Cambridge.
Needham.
Yeah.
Does he maintain that?
Yes, I think so.
Well, I mean, he certainly maintains that there were a huge number of inventions that came out of China.
There was a huge scientific...